This is Audible.
Scholastic Audio presents Fever Crumb, written and read for you by Philip Reeve. Part 1. Chapter 1. The Girl from Godsawk's Head. That morning they were making paperboys. Fever had gone down at dawn to the pressing room to collect 14 of the big furled sheets of paper, 6 feet square, which Dr. Isbister made by pulping and pressing foolish old books that his library did not need. Then she had carried them carefully back up the winding wooden stairways of the head, to the chambers that she shared with Dr. Crumb. There they had set to work. Fever was just the right size now to lie on each sheet while Dr. Crumb drew an outline all round her with his pencil. When that was done, she fetched 2 pairs of paper shears, and they carefully cut out the silhouettes. Soon 14 of her blank white selves lay stacked on the workbench. Fever stood at Dr. Crumb's side, watching but not speaking, while he spread out one of the cutouts and laid a thin wire skeleton on top of it. He took care over the hands with their complicated little mechanisms, and the dim white metal discs like flimsy coins, which were the paperboy's eyes and brain. These were old-world mechanisms, and if they were damaged they could never be replaced, for no one knew the secrets of their making any more. They had been recycled from one generation of paperboys to the next, ever since the Scriven first brought them down out of the unknown north. When all the mechanisms were correctly positioned, Fever helped Dr. Crumb to coat the paper figure with paste. Then they took a second cutout and stuck it precisely over the first, so that the two cutouts formed a Fever-shaped paper sandwich with the metal parts hidden inside. Together they carried it to the bath that stood in a corner of the room and laid it in the solution. At first the paperboy just floated on the surface, like a dead leaf on a pond, but Fever took rubber-tipped tongs and gently pressed it down until the solution flowed over it and it sank. While Dr. Crumb set to work on the next paperboy, Fever got her fingers under the edge of the bath and tilted it gently up and down, so that the solution shifted but did not spill, and the paperboy slid to and fro under the surface, his head and feet banging alternately against the ends of the bath. Fever thought that it would be more rational to call the device a paper girl, since it had been drawn around her. But Dr. Crumb said that it was not alive and had no gender. So why are they called paper boys? A good point, Fever. The name is foolish and was clearly not invented by a man of reason. When all 7 paper boys had been made and soaked, they lifted them out of the bath one by one and held them up so that the excess solution could drain off. Then, carrying the dripping figures on a rack between them, they left the workroom and went up the stairs and out onto the roof. "This is a great waste of time," said Dr. Crumb, as they pegged the paper boys out like laundry for the brisk west wind to dry. "Why the new council does not just ask their master of devices to make paper boys for them, I fail to understand. Master Wormtimber was once a member of our order, and surely he cannot have forgotten everything he learned from us." "Perhaps the new council knows you make them best, Dr. Crumb," said Fever loyally. "And maybe they want paper boys they can be sure of, if there is really to be a war." "There is not going to be a war," said Dr. Crumb. "But Dr. Isbister told me that a nomad horde is approaching from the north." "As our order's librarian, it is one of Dr. Isbister's duties to read the city newspapers, and I'm afraid they fill his mind with rumours and scaremongery. This is not the first time one of the nomad empires has moved south. They will not dare to attack London, though if they did, I doubt that a few paper boys could do much to stop them." The drying paper boys flapped and crockled, a line of white dancers strung between 2 ventilator cowls. Specks of rust and dust blew against them, and stuck to the still wet paper, so Fever and Dr. Crumb went to and fro, patiently picking them off. After a while, as the boys began to dry, Dr. Crumb went back below, leaving Fever to keep an eye on them. She walked to the roof's edge and lay down, enjoying the warmth of the sun. It was July, the height of London's brief summer. Bees droned past her, and the cries of hawkers came up faintly from the deep streets, where she could see people and carts and sedan chairs moving. Jackdaws called and squabbled around the strange old blue metal towers in Clerkenwell. Wind trams, under their clouds of sunlit sail, went rattling along their spindly viaducts. And somewhere beneath her, more as a vibration in her breastbone than an actual sound, Fever could hear the voices of old Dr. Collyhole and his assistants, as they laboured in his attic workspace, assembling the vast paper balloon in which he planned one day soon to begin the reconquest of the skies. Fever was the youngest member of the Order of Engineers, and the only female. Engineers did not have wives or children. But one evening, 14 years before, Dr. Crumb had been called out to a dig on the Brick Marsh by an archaeologist named Chigley Unthank, who wanted an opinion on some ancient artifacts which he'd unearthed, and on his way back he had heard crying coming from an old weed-grown pit close to the road. There, among the bramble bushes, he had found a baby in a basket, with an old blanket laid over her and a label tied around her wrist, upon which someone had written just 4 words. Her name is Fever. He had told Fever the story often when she was little. Dr. Crumb did not believe in telling lies, not even white lies, not even to little girls. He had not wanted her to grow up thinking she was his. She knew how he had stood there in the twilight, staring down at the baby in the basket, and how finally, not knowing what else to do, he had carried her back with him to Godshawk's Head. In earlier years, he might have taken her to the civic orphanage, but that was the summer of the Skinners' riots, and the orphanage had been wrecked and looted, along with much of the rest of the city. In London's rougher boroughs, like Limehouse and St. Kylie, the skins of murdered scriven still flapped like speckled flags from poles that the Skinners had set up at street corners. The collection of merchants and lawyers who called themselves the New Council had not yet completely restored order. Dr. Crumb made up a little bed for the foundling in a spare drawer of his plan chest, and fed her watered-down milk through a laboratory pipette. Looking into her eyes, he noticed that they were different colours, the left dark brown, the right soft lichen grey. Was that where she had been abandoned? Had her mother been afraid that her neighbours would take that small oddity for a sign that the child was a scriven or some other sort of misshape, and kill her? There was a small wound on the back of her head, a thin cut not quite healed. Dr. Crumb, who had seen for himself the savagery of the Skinners, imagined some crazed Londoner slashing at her with a knife. The other engineers, gathering round him to peer at the tiny refugee, had all agreed with him. The child must not go back to live among those savage, superstitious Londoners. She would stay with the Order, in Godshawk's Head, and Dr. Crumb would act as her guardian. Girls had never been admitted to the Order before, since it was well known that female minds were not capable of rational thought. But if little Fever were to be brought up in the ways of the Order from infancy, was there not a chance that she might make a useful engineer? So here she lay, 14 summers later, in the sunshine on the Head's roof. She had grown into an odd-looking girl, and her clothes made her look odder still. Only someone who had spent 14 years being told that appearances don't matter would dress in clothes like those. Big digger's boots, skinny black trousers, an old grey shirt, a white canvas coat with metal buttons. Then there was her hair, or rather her lack of hair. The Order was keen to hurry humankind into the future, and they believed that hair was unnecessary. Fever shaved her head every other morning, and had done so for so long that she didn't remember what colour her hair would be if she were to let it grow. And below the bald dome of her head, she had a curious face, with a short, sudden nose and a wide mouth, thick, fair eyebrows, and oddest of all, those large eyes that didn't match. Yet somehow it all worked. It was one of those rare faces which bypassed pretty and went straight to beautiful. Of course, that would never have occurred to Fever. She attached no importance to her looks, but she was beautiful all the same, as she lay there watching the city and waiting for the paper boys to dry and idly tracing the raised line of that old scar that she could feel but never see, a slender silvery thread which curved along the base of her skull. Chapter 2. An Offer of Employment. Godshawk's Head was not a building. It really was a head. Auric Godshawk, the last of London's scriven overlords, had planned to commemorate his rule with an immense statue of himself. But he had gotten no further than this metal head, 7 stories high, which stood near Oxfart Circus on a patch of waste ground, surrounded by the huge abandoned smelting and rolling sheds where it had been constructed. The scriven had arrived in London 200 years before. Driven out of their northern homelands by some power shift among the nomad empires, they swept south in search of a city to conquer, and London, rich in trade and archaeology, had drawn them like magpies. After smashing London's army at the Battle of Barnet, they dragged their mobile fortress onto the summit of Ludgate Hill, tore off its wheels, and converted it into the Barbican, the stronghold from which scriven kings would rule over the city for the next 2 centuries. They were brilliant, cruel, and party-mad, and they were not exactly human beings. In the black time after the downsizing, all sorts of mutations had come whirling down the helter-skelter of the human DNA spiral, and the Skriven claimed to be a new species entirely. Homo superior, they liked to call themselves, or sometimes Homo futuris, the idea being that they had come into the world to replace dull old Homo sapiens. They were strange in a lot of ways you couldn't easily put your finger on, and in one way that you could. Their pale skin was blotched and dappled with markings, like leopard's spots. Some Skriven's spots were freckle-coloured, others were dark as spilled ink. The Skriven prized dark markings most. They believed that they had each been written on by a god called the Skrivener, who had inscribed the future history of the world upon their skins. Skriven scholars spent whole lifetimes making drawings of other Skriven in the nude, and trying to decipher the Scrivener's sacred ideograms. But like most mutant strains, the Skriven hadn't thrived for long. The genetic peculiarities of which they were so proud turned out to be their downfall. All of London's previous conquerors had intermarried with native Londoners and had children who were Londoners themselves. But although some Skriven took human wives and lovers, no children ever came of those unions. Even Skriven marriages were often barren. By the time Godsork began work on his giant statue, there were only a few hundred Skriven left, lording it over a city of 60,000. The taxes needed to pay for it, and the slave labour used in its building, helped spark the Skinner's riots, in which Godsork and all the other Skriven had been slaughtered. The rioters had swirled all through London, burning and smashing anything connected with the Skriven, but they'd not been able to do much damage to that titanic head. When the smoke cleared, it was still standing, its stern face dented and daubed with angry slogans. There had been a housing shortage after the riots. The burning down of buildings, it turned out, had been a bad idea in a city made mostly of timber and thatch, and the unpopular Order of Engineers, who had taken no part in the uprising, and many of whose members had worked for Skriven masters, were thrown out of their big guild house on Ludgate Hill to make room for displaced families. It seemed logical that rather than waiting for a new guild house to be built while their valuable collections sat mouldering in makeshift huts, they should just move into Godsork's head. It was hollow, mostly weathertight, and very big. The builders had left scaffolding inside that formed the basis of floors and walls and stairways. The engineers glazed Godsork's eyes and poked dozens of smaller windows in his cheeks and forehead. They gave him a tar-paper roof like a bad hat. The head was only intended to be a temporary accommodation, but it became permanent. After all, as the engineers liked to joke in their dry, unfunny way, it was most appropriate that they should live in a head. Hadn't they always said that they were the brains of the city? That night, when the paperboys had been taken down and packed in boxes and sent up to the Barbican, and Fever was washing up after the evening meal in the tiny kitchen which adjoined Dr. Crumb's workspace, there came a tapping on the door. She put down the dish she had been wiping and reached for a towel to dry her hands. But Dr. Crumb had already left his workbench and gone to see who their visitor was. Fever could not see the door from where she stood in the kitchen, but she heard it open and heard the voice of Dr. Staling. Fever wondered what could have brought the chief engineer to their quarters at such a late hour. She was almost tempted to eavesdrop on what he and Dr. Crumb were talking about, but she reminded herself to be reasonable. "There is no profit in wondering why Dr. Staling has come here," she thought. "It may be nothing to do with you, Fever Crumb, and if it is, you shall find out about it in good time." So she made herself go on with her chores, carefully wiping and drying each plate, dish and utensil, and putting them back in their places on the kitchen shelves. A place for everything, and everything in that place, was one of the rules that Dr. Crumb had taught her when she was very little. She was just emptying the dirty water out of the kitchen window, when Dr. Crumb called to her, "Fever! Dr. Staling would like to speak with you." So it did have something to do with her. She put the bowl upside down on the sill to drain, then shut the window. She ran a hand over her head, glad that she had shaved that morning. Then she went through into the workroom. Dr. Staling was a tall, broad-shouldered old man. He shaved his head like all the order, but he didn't bother to clip the hairs in his nostrils, which were long and steely grey and quivered when he breathed. Fever, facing him, reminded herself that it would be childish to find that distracting. "Fever," said Dr. Crumb, looking worried, "Dr. Staling has a proposal for you." "It is not my proposal, you understand," said Dr. Staling, with that North Country accent of his, which grew stronger when he was excited. "Kit Solent, a minor archaeologist, has asked me to supply an engineer to live at his house on Ludgate Hill and help him to study artifacts from a new site he has discovered. He has requested you, Fever. Fever, like a good engineer, showed no emotion, but beneath her white coat her heart began to beat very quickly. Fever is very young to be sent out on such a placement, said Dr. Crumb.
Nevertheless, Crumb, you're always telling us how rational and capable she is, and it is perfectly usual for young engineers to be sent out into the world. Only then do we find out if they are truly men of reason, or if they will fall prey to the world's temptations. You did it yourself, Crumb.
Yes, said Dr. Crumb, looking suddenly flustered. Yes, I did, and it was a troubling period. Difficult. Dr. Stalling went and stood at the window, gazing out across the great, smoky, unreasonable city. He said, I always had high hopes for young Solent. As a young man, he struck me as having a very rational mind. Made some interesting discoveries. Remember that old underground railway station down by the Marsh Gate? That was one of his finds. Remarkable state of preservation. Then he went and married some digger's daughter, and that was the end of his usefulness. They busied themselves mooning about and having babies for a few years, and then the girl died. And ever since, he's just looked after the children while living off his savings, which I should imagine are getting pretty low by now. I'm pleased to hear that he's digging again. It is rational for the Order to encourage him in any way we can.
Fever thought that she liked the sound of Master Solent, although she knew it was irrational to form an opinion based on such little knowledge of him. Still, she looked hopefully at Dr. Crumb, wondering if he would let her go.
Dr. Crumb still looked troubled. He said, Fever is a great help to me here, Dr. Stalling. What shall I do without her?
Oh, I'll ask young Quillman to come up and assist you, Crumb. He's highly rational. And it is only for a short time, 3 weeks or a month. So pack your bag, Fever Crumb. You'll be leaving for Ludgate Hill tomorrow.
Chapter 3. The Wind Tram. The main entrance to Godsawk's head was not through its mouth, as you might expect, for annoyingly Godsawk's sculptor had chosen to represent him with his lips firmly closed. Instead, the Order and their visitors came and went through a door at the top of a flight of steps that led up the head's left nostril. Out of that door, and down those steps next morning, came Fever Crumb, in the pearl-grey London daylight, pushing open the gate in the high fence which ran all round the head, and walking out onto the tram stop, which was a timber platform built on piles against Godsawk's upper lip. Dr. Crumb came with her. He had carried her cardboard suitcase from their quarters, and he would have liked to carry it farther. He would have liked to go with her all the way to Solent's house, and see what sort of place she was to live in, and among what kinds of people. Fever would have liked that, too, but neither of them dared suggest it, for fear the other would think them irrational. So they stood on the head's wooden moustache in the gusty, biting wind, and wondered what to say. The tram was due, but as yet there was no sign of it. The wire-link fence sang thinly in the breeze. "The wind is still from the west," observed Dr. Crumb at last. "You'll have a good, brisk run to the terminus, and from there I believe it is but a short walk to Solent's place." Fever agreed. They stood facing each other, the collars of their white coats turned up against the wind. On Fever's head was a wide-brimmed straw hat that Dr. Crumb had unearthed from somewhere, saying she would need it to protect her scalp from the sun. She held it on tightly, and watched the thick gunmetal clouds sweep above the city, and thought about sums, angles, anything that would take her mind off what she was feeling. She didn't want to go. She wanted to stay in the head forever. She wanted Dr. Crumb to hold her hand and lead her back inside. She felt afraid of living without him, and angry at him for not standing up to Dr. Stalling and insisting that she stay. But she knew, too, that those feelings, like all feelings, were irrational. They were the frightened instincts of a small animal leaving the nest for the first time. Everyone had instincts, just as everyone had hair. They were another vestige of humanity's primitive past. A good engineer learned to suppress them. The tram lines began to chirrup, and then to hum. She glanced to windward, and there was the tram coming down the long sweep of the viaduct that carried it above the roofs of Wary Edge. In another half minute it would be at Godsawk's head. She turned back to Dr. Crumb, and almost lost control and hugged him, but by then a whole crowd of engineers were coming out of Godsawk's nostril like a highly educated sneeze. And what would they think of her if they saw her acting on her feelings? They would think that they had been right all those years ago, and that girls were not suited to the ways of reason. So she held tight to the handle of her suitcase with one hand, and kept that farm girl hat in place with the other, and just nodded to Dr. Crumb. And Dr. Crumb nodded back, and wiped his eyes with his coat cuff, and said, "Bother this wind."
"Farewell, Fevercrumb," called the other engineers. "Good luck. Be reasonable." And she bowed to them too, and then the tram was almost alongside the platform, and there was nothing to do but turn and run for it, while Dr. Crumb, in a voice too small for her or anyone else to hear, said, "Take care, little Fever. Take care." Fever had often watched wind trams pass the head, but she had never boarded one before. There was a worrying gap between the platform's edge and the tram's deck, but her legs were long and strong, and she leapt it easily and dumped herself on one of the slatted wooden seats behind the main mast. The tram did not slow, but kept trundling past the tram stop at a steady 12 miles per hour, so that the head fell quickly astern, and was soon hidden behind a terrace of 30th-century villas. Fever set her suitcase down on the deck between her feet, and groped in her pocket for the coins that Dr. Crumb had given her. The tram conductor, a squat man with a wooden leg, came stumping aft, and she said, "The central terminus," and put the coins in his hand. In return, he gave her an oyster shell and an expectant stare, as if he was waiting for a thank you. But Fever did not see any reason to say thank you. He had not done her a favour, merely his job. After a moment, he stopped waiting and went on his way, muttering something to another of the tram crew, who laughed nastily. The oyster shell hung on a cord, threaded through a hole bored in its edge. Everyone who travelled by London Transport wore one. Fever took off her hat and looped the cord over her head and put her hat back on and sat on her uncomfortable seat and watched the city slide by. The cloud cover was breaking and a stook of sunbeams stood on Ludgate Hill, gilding the wet roofs of the Barbican and the copper-topped towers of the Astrologers' Guild. For the first time, the bad, breathless feeling which had seized her when she was saying goodbye to Dr. Crumb began to fade, and in its place came something which she thought of as positive anticipation, but which someone who had not been brought up by engineers would have called excitement. More houses went by, their top-floor windows level with the tram line. Then the weed-grown summit of a digger's spoil heap, with goats grazing among the buddleia. They passed other stations, where people jumped nimbly aboard, carrying children and shopping and cumbersome packages, squeezing into the seats on either side of Fever's. The wind died a little as the tram nosed its way deeper into the built-up heart of the city, passing into the lee of tall buildings. Ahead, flocks of dust-grey pigeons wheeled around the thatched roofs of the central terminus, in the shadow of Ludgate Hill. The tram crew furled their flapping sails, took up long poles, and quanted the rest of the way, only stopping when they reached the incline outside the terminus, down which the tram coasted until it fetched up with a jarring thump against the straw buffers. "Central terminus! A light here for Ludgate Hill, Liverpool Street and the Struggle Market! Change here for stops to Bankment Side, St. Kiley, Hampstead Heath and Effin Forest!" And oh, the noise of it. Fever was pummeled by the din and stink and bustle that greeted her as she climbed down from the tram and made her way along the platform, which was spattered with pigeon droppings and clumps of filthy straw fallen from the high, thatched canopy overhead. Stevedores shunted trolleys piled with crates and barrels at Fever, and left it to her to decide whether she would leap aside or be crushed under their wheels. Men shouted to one another as they ran up the masts of lately arrived trams to furl their sails. Doors slammed and handbells rang as other trams pulled out, laden with freight and passengers. She clutched her little cardboard suitcase to her chest and hurried on until she reached the wooden turnstile at the platform's end. There she held up her oyster shell, while the eyes of the turnstile keeper flicked over her in a bored, faintly aggressive way before letting her through. At once she found herself caught up in a river of Londoners, which was swirling across the concourse and down a broad flight of wooden stairs and out into the street to join a still larger river outside. Drovers were herding sheep toward the meat market. Barrow boys and news sheet vendors were shouting their wares, and dozens of sedan chairs were being carried past, bobbing on that tide of hats and heads like over-decorated cupboards washed away in a flood. Fever fished in her pocket with one hand for the directions that Dr. Staling had given her, while keeping tight hold of the handle of her suitcase with the other. Dr. Crumb had warned her of the sneak thieves and dip pockets who haunted London's busier streets. She peered at Dr. Staling's sketch map, but she could not relate the neat lines he had drawn to the complex, busy, jagged streets in which she found herself. She looked about for a street name or a signpost, but there were none. The river of people swept her on. The low sun was lighting the upper parts of the buildings, and a window flashed as a maid leaned out to empty a chamber pot. Fever jumped aside just in time to dodge the shower of urine, and stumbled into the path of a religious procession, celebrants in robes and pointed hats, whirling and clapping and chanting the name of some old-world prophet, Harry Harry, Harry Potter. Disgusted, Fever veered away, but all around her now were the signs of unreason. Temples to Poskett and Mad Isa, and dozens more of London's shabby gods, with the ramshackle copper-domed towers of the astrologers poking up over their roofs. Shops and stalls sold scents and prayer flags and dream catchers and impractical hats and cheap storybooks with lurid covers. Barrow boys swore and squabbled. Women passed by with painted faces, wearing skirts so wide that small wheels had been attached to the hems to stop them from dragging in the street muck, while little gas balloons held up the points of their flamboyant, lacy collars. It was small wonder, Fever thought, that the Order of Engineers had long ago decided to cloister themselves away from such a world, with all its disorder and distractions. Round a corner she went, and down steep, cobbled streets that kept turning into stairways. Down? No, that must be wrong. She looked at the map again. She should be going uphill. She was growing confused and panicky, but she was still rational enough to see the truth. She had been alone in the city for barely 5 minutes, and already she was lost. Chapter 4. Straggle Market. Trying to think in the calm and scientific way that Dr. Crum had taught her, Fever turned her back on the sun and started following a nearby viaduct, hoping that it would lead her back to the terminus. But the viaduct was not easy to follow. Scruffy buildings leaned against its supports. Archaeological digs opened in the middle of streets, and in detouring round them she soon lost sight of the tram line altogether. She did not notice the black sedan chair that cut through the crowds 100 feet behind her, dogging her path like a large, square shark. She took wrong turn after wrong turn, and ended up on a street with high, abandoned-looking warehouses on either side. In front of the buildings, small-time scavengers and archaeologists had set out their wares on trestles under canvas awnings, or spread them on blankets on the cobbled ground. Fever tasted a sudden tang of homesickness as she looked down into a hamper filled with old mobile phone carapaces, just like the ones she had so often cleaned and polished for Dr. Crum. On other stools she glimpsed intriguing knots of old wiring and circuitry, and once a whole engine. But most of the traders were simply selling junk, shapeless old clots of crushed plastic and rust, whose purpose not even an engineer could hope to guess. "Hello, ducks," called a toothless old woman, seeing Fever glance at the rust-stained stones that were spread on her blanket. "Treat yourself to a bargain, dearie." She snatched at Fever's sleeve, and Fever looked round into her mad old face. The woman's eyes widened. Her grin turned into something different. "What are you?" she asked. She started to back away, pointing with one arm at Fever's face while she used the other to elbow a path for herself through the crowd. "Her eyes!" she squealed. "Her eyes! She's one of them!" "Please do stop it," said Fever. But her voice was small, no more than a whisper, really, while the old woman's had risen to a wheezy shriek. "Scriven! She be Scriven!" Heads were turning. People were noticing Fever, and they weren't the sort of people she wanted to be noticed by. Burly barrow boys, rag-robed scavengers, crop-headed London roughs with tattooed necks. With startling speed, a ring of gawpers congealed around her, attracted by the scent of coming violence. Someone knocked Fever's hat off, and as she stooped to pick it up, she heard them muttering, "Look at her! She's got no hair! No hair!" "I'm an engineer," said Fever, straightening up. "I shave my head. Hair is unnecessary and provides a home to lice and fleas. It is a vestige of our animal past." But none of the people round her looked as though they'd know what vestige meant, or believe that mankind was descended from the animals. They weren't listening anyway. "She's tall enough, but she ain't got no speckles," said one man, peering into Fever's face. "She ain't no Scriven." "But look at them eyes," another urged. "She's some sort of misshape, all right. How could she be human, yet have eyes that don't match?" "Of course I'm human," said Fever weakly. But the men were all suspicious now, and that word misshape had been enough to rouse a wary hatred from deep in their folk memory. Mutations were rare, and not many had been as long-lasting or as dangerous as the Scriven, but most Londoners still believed in stamping out misshapes wherever you found them, just in case. Fever looked around, hoping to find someone in the crowd she might appeal to. There was no one. Some were jeering and laughing at her, while others looked ready to murder her. "Your behaviour is irrational," she told them, hoping to calm them, but she could not seem to make them understand. They clumped closer, leering, one man reaching out to prod her. Behind their faces, like something in a dream, a black sedan chair slid toward her, swinging side on. As the crowd sensed it and turned their heads to look, Fever saw her chance and fled. She found a side alley and darted down it, her cardboard suitcase banging its corners against her legs, shouts breaking out behind her, a rotten cabbage bursting against the damp brickwork of the alley wall. For a moment there was panic and wet cobbles and the slap of her running feet. Then she rounded a corner into another alley, and there was the black chair again, blocking the way ahead. "Miss Crumb?" A man was leaning from the chair's open door, calling out to her as she turned to run back the way she'd come. He opened the chair's door and reached out a hand to Fever. "Come on, Miss Crumb," he said. "The Straggle Market's no place to hang about, not for a stranger." He smiled, and his smile made her feel safer. "I'm Kit Solent," he said. "Staling told me you weren't used to being out alone, so I decided to come and meet you at the station. I called, but you must not have heard me. Not your fault, of course. Once you get caught in the crowd, you end up going where it takes you." Another crowd, the angry Straggle Market mob, was approaching fast along the same alley Fever had just run down. She could hear their voices, harsh as animals. "Come on, hop in," said Kit Solent. Fever decided that the rational thing would be to do as he asked. She passed up her case to him and clambered inside, feeling the chair dip beneath her as the bearers adjusted to her weight. Then Kit Solent tugged shut the door and rapped once with his knuckles on the wall behind his head. The chair set off at a brisk walking pace, back up the alley Fever had just run down, herding her pursuers ahead of it. Solent gestured to Fever to keep her head down and leaned from the window, calling out, "She's not come this way!" Crouching between the two bench seats, Fever's eyes grew used to the shadows of the chair. She saw that two children were sitting beside Solent, a boy of about 8 years and a little girl much younger. They sat close together and watched Fever solemnly, like a pair of owls. The girl was clutching some sort of pretend animal, a blue dog made from fluff and wool. "There," said Kit Solent, helping her up and grinning at her as she settled herself on the seat opposite him. The Straggle Market was behind them. The chair was climbing through quieter streets, up the side of Ludgate Hill. "Miss Crumb, I do believe you're the most exciting employee we've ever had. We have had a sedan chair chase and a near riot, and it's not yet time for elevenses. You must have a perfect genius for getting into trouble." Fever blushed. "It was no fault of mine," she said, peeking through the tiny window behind his head to make sure they were not being followed. "Those people were most irrational." "They were scared, Miss Crumb," Kit Solent replied. "Don't you know your history? The Scriven used to run this city, and they were cruel and wicked and not altogether human. Anybody who looks a bit different tends to remind people of them." He smiled at Fever. He was older than Dr. Crumb, but not nearly as old as Dr. Staling, a large, handsome man, slightly overweight, with an intelligent face, blue eyes, long chestnut-coloured hair tied back with a silver clasp, scruffy clothes, an ink stain on his shirt cuff. Fever remembered him now. He had visited the head several times, and she had looked down from the window of Dr. Crumb's chambers and watched Dr. Staling greeting him when he stepped off the wind tram. The little girl tugged at Solent's sleeve, and he leaned down to listen to what she whispered. "That's right, Fern. She's got no hair." The girl went back to staring at Fever, her small chin pressed against the head of the toy animal. Kit Solent said, "This is my daughter Fern, and my son, Ruin." "Good morning, Miss Crumb," said the boy. Fever nodded warily. The only child she had ever known was her own younger self. All she remembered about childhood was longing to grow up so that she would understand things as well as Dr. Crumb and be a child no longer. She had no idea what she should say to these two, who were staring at her so expectantly. She felt her ears turning pink. It occurred to her that there was a purpose to hair. It hid your ears so that nobody could see them flush when you were embarrassed. "Your order has kept you something of a secret, Fever," said Kit Solent chattily. "A girl engineer? I had no idea that there were such animals until Dr. Staling mentioned you. He tells me you're the best of their apprentices. I decided at once that you were the girl to help me with my project. So much nicer for the children to have a young person about the house instead of some stern old man." Fever's ears felt hotter and hotter. One of the Order's best apprentices? Dr. Staling would hardly have called her that if he had seen the unreasonable panic she had gotten herself into simply trying to find her way to Solent's house. To avoid having to look at Kit Solent, she stared out of the window instead, and saw that the chair was turning onto a shabby street that curved along the southeastern flank of Ludgate Hill. The tall houses, which had been the homes of the Scriven and their wealthy human collaborators, still showed signs of damage from the Skinner's riots. Many were burned-out shells. Even those that were still standing had boarded windows, and the summer weeds waved head-high in their gardens. Fever knew that London's population had dwindled in the years since the riots, as people moved south to warmer, safer, richer cities. But she had not realised that whole streets of houses lay abandoned so close to the Barbican. Or perhaps not quite abandoned. Outside one of those gaunt, derelict villas, the chair slowed, then turned in through the rusted open gates to stop on a stretch of weedy gravel outside the front door. "Here we are," said Solent brightly, and stepped out of the chair as the chairman set it down, lifting Fern out after him and leaving Fever and Ruin to make their own way out while he rummaged in his purse for coins to pay the panting bearers. Fever stood on the gravel and looked up at the place where she was expected to live. It was a tall building, standing alone in what must have been gardens back in Scriven times, but were now a wasteland of brambles and overgrown topiary. Tall clumps of nettles swayed in the breeze, releasing their clouds of pollen like faint breaths of smoke. Most of the lower windows were boarded up, but some on the upper floors still had glass, dusty, dirty glass, behind which swags of coloured material had been pinned up as curtains. High above, she saw a battered roof and some listing chimney pots. Solent caught her by the arm and propelled her up the front steps. "Welcome, Miss Crumb," he said, bending to unlock the heavy door. "Welcome to number 17 Ludgate Hill Gardens, my humble home."
Chapter 5. At the Sign of the Mott and Hoople. Of all the pubs in many taverned London, the Mott and Hoople on Ditch Street was the dimmest, the dingiest, the darkest and the most dangerous. There had been a tavern on that spot for centuries, and the centuries seemed hardly to have changed it. It still held the same stale smell, still wore the same bull's-eyes of bottle-bottom glass in its stingy little windows, still had the same sick and sawdust-covered floors, and the same old jar of ancient gherkins standing by the beer pumps on the bar. And behind the bar, the Mott's landlord, Ted Swiney, who grinned and joked and acted the jolly host and stayed sober always, watching with mean, cunning little piggish eyes while the customers squandered their last few farthings on his booze. That morning the talk in the Mott and Hoople was all about the news from the north. London's two newspapers, The Standard and The Alarmist, which could usually agree about nothing at all, both claimed that a nomad outfit called The Movement was pushing south. The Standard said they were refugees, dislodged from their own holdings up north by the deepening ice, while The Alarmist reckoned they were invaders, bent on taking London for themselves. Both papers wanted to know why the trained bands, London's part-time militia, had not been sent north to reinforce the guards and lookouts who manned the orbital moatway. The drinkers in the Mott and Hoople wanted to know too. Ted listened to their grumbling while he wiped the glasses clean. He was pleased by the edge of worry that he heard in their voices. When people got worried, they started looking to the new council to do something, and the new council were a bunch of hapless do-gooders who were completely incapable of doing anything. Frustration and anger and violence would result, and it seemed to Ted that a man who understood the needs and workings of the London mob might use that anger to his own advantage. Because Ted had ambitions. He'd come from nothing to make himself a big man in that part of town. As well as the Mott and Hoople, he had two other pubs, the Blogger's Arms on Bankment Side and the Polished Turd in Battersea. He owned the Brimstone Brewery too, and a row of tenements in Lemon Heel, which he let out at fearsome rents to low-end archaeologists and bar girls. It seemed to him that it was only Lord Mayor Gilpin Ween and them other do-gooding poofs on the new council who were stopping him from being bigger still. Secretly, down in the basement of his mind, he stored a sly and precious dream, Tedward Swiney as Mayor of London. "Those nomad empires are tough," a digger at the bar was saying, "and they're tooled up with all kinds of old tech and terrible ancient weapons what they dig up out of the ice wastes. Everyone knows the movement's spies come in and out of London as they please," said another, a man with the stained hands and leather apron of a plastic smith, "dressed up as merchants and riding on them foreign land barges." Ted shook his head, coming round the bar's end to kick fresh sawdust over a mound of last night's vomit and put the latest smell by Prince Nays into the pub's battered scent lantern. The men fell silent,
waiting to hear what he thought of it all.
"You're right," he said. "The new council are too weak to stand up to this foreign muck. They never stood up to the Patchskins, did they? While us poor folk was suffering and dying, Gilpin Ween and his like was sitting quiet and building up their businesses and bowing and scraping. Yes, my Lord Scriven. No, my Lord Scriven. It was us who risked our necks to throw the Scriven down, but it was them who picked up their power, all them lawyers and antiquaries and do-gooders. And you think they're going to raise a finger to save us from these nomad nanas? They're probably in league with the movement themselves, half of them."
His listeners nodded wisely, pleased to have their worst fears confirmed.
"Still," said Ted, brightening a bit, "this is London, eh? We sorted out the Dapplejacks, didn't we? And we'll sort out these new clutes if they try and get across the motway. All we need is a good hard man to lead us."
He stumped back behind his bar and started refilling a mug which one of the men held out to him.
"Let 'em come. One proper Londoner's worth 100 foreigners."
At which point, right on cue, the door banged open and a proper Londoner came in. A gaunt old man, dressed in a quilted coat so long that it brushed his boot heels, and so black that it seemed to suck the colour from his long, hollow face, leaving it white as a paper mask. His hair was white too, trailing in greasy rat tails over his coat collar. In his right hand was a thick black staff, and on his head a black bowler hat, gone greenish with age, the binding of the brim come loose and hanging down in tatters. He paused, leaning on his staff in the lit oblong of the doorway, and announced his arrival with a long fit of wet, wheezing coughs.
"It's Creech," said Ted Swiney.
Men whispered, nudging one another, until all heads had turned to stare at the newcomer.
"It's Bagman Creech."
Space was hastily made for him at the bar. A stool was dusted and pulled out for him. Men whipped their caps off. Bagman Creech was a hero. When the Skinners' Guilds rose up to rid London of the Scriven tyrants, Bagman Creech had been their general. You could see paintings of him even now, done 30 feet tall on the walls of tenements in Limehouse and St. Kiley, holding up a Patchskin's head and shouting out the Skinners' war cry in curly-whirly script.
"This ain't genocide. This is rock and roll."
Of course, he'd aged a bit. The new council, which had been formed after the riots, had taken steps to stamp out the Skinners' Guilds. They were glad to be rid of the Scriven, of course, but order had to be restored. Bagman Creech had objected, so they arrested him and chucked him in the Clink prison. You could see how he'd suffered there by the pained, rheumatic way he walked. You could hear it in the steady wheezing of his breath, and the cough that rumbled endlessly down in the wet cellars of his lungs.
"Morning, Ted Swiney," he rasped,
reaching the bar and propping his black staff against it.
"Bagman," said Swiney, with a nod. "What do you say to a pint of brimstone best?" "I'm not stopping," said Bagman Creech.
His voice had been sanded away until only a whisper remained. The men at the bar leaned closer to hear.
"I'm working. I heard a misshape was seen up the Straggle Market this morning."
That was the other thing about Bagman Creech. Unlike the rest of London, he'd never been convinced that the Scriven were gone for good. He'd always believed that some had escaped and were lurking somewhere, out on Tyburn Waste or deep in the mazes of the Brick Marsh, waiting for a chance to take revenge. Old and ill as he was, he still spent his days a-googling for them, wherever they might hide. Ted wiped a mug and shook his head.
"I heard that too. Lily Dismas said she saw a Dapplejack. Mad as a spoon, she is."
Bagman Creech had pale, hooded eyes with a winter light in them.
"If Lil's mad, it's because the Scriven drove her mad," he said. 10 years she spent in their lock-ups. If she says this girl she saw was Scriven, she was Scriven, and it falls to me to track her down and do what's needful. People are scared, Ted Swiney, and if you won't help 'em, then I will."
Ted set the mug he'd been polishing down on the bar and returned the old Skinner's stare. Not many men could have spoken to him like that and gotten out of the mot alive. Creech was different, though. A man in Ted's position had to show respect for the old Skinner. He said,
"What I heard was that girl in the Straggle Market got took away in a chair." "I heard that too," said Creech. "You know whose chair it was?"
"Search me, Bagman. A taxi, probably. I don't know."
"I'll keep asking, then."
Bagman turned, suppressing another gust of coughing, and started back towards the doors. Ted watched him go. He had the uneasy feeling that he might have made a mistake. If the Commons were getting panicky about a scriven on the loose, he had to show them that Ted Swiney took their fears seriously. "Creech!" He threw out the word like a fishhook. Creech stopped as if it had snagged the back of his coat. Turned. "You need a hand?" asked Ted. "You don't sound well. I bet you could use a boy to do some of the legwork." He was stamping, as he spoke, on the trapdoor behind the bar, which led down to the cellar where the beer was stored. It yawned open, and a shabby boy of 11 or 12 came scrambling up, clutching a mop in one hand and already cringing in readiness for a blow from the back of Ted's hand. "Charlie Shallow," said Ted Swiney. "You're about bright enough to run an errand, ain't you? Carry a letter, knock at a door, maybe cook up Master Creech's supper of an evening." "Yes, Ted," the boy said meekly, looking at the floor. Ted turned in triumph to the old Skinner. "There, you take him, Bagman. Borrow him for as long as you like. Compliments of all at the Mott and Hoople. A man of your advancing years could use a servant, and I've got plenty. You take this one." Charlie Shallow hung his head, too meek to meet the Skinner's gaze. Creech coughed softly, deep inside himself. He was about to say that he worked alone, always and only alone, and that hunting scriven was no job for a kid. But something about the boy, maybe his wan, weazen face, or the way his whole thin body leaned away from Ted Swiney, still waiting for a blow, something made him change his mind. Anyway, the publican was right. He wasn't as young as he used to be. He could use some help.
"That's highly appreciated, Ted," he said.
"There you go, Charlie," said Ted Swiney, grabbing Charlie by his scuffled hair and shoving him round the end of the bar. "You go with Master Creech. You do as he tells you." Charlie Shallow stumbled across the sawdust floor and looked up into his new master's face. Lean as a skull it looked, and those deep-set eyes were like windows into somewhere where you wouldn't want to go. But he couldn't be any worse than Ted Swiney, could he? Some of the men at the bar, who had never noticed Charlie Shallow before, reached out now to tousle his hair and thump him on his bony shoulders. "Brave kid," they mumbled, "and good luck." Bagman Creech just turned toward the door again and said,
"Fetch your stuff, boy, and follow me."
He walked to the doorway and out into the street, waiting there in the sunshine, away from the reek of sickness and scent lanterns. Charlie, who had no stuff to fetch, was about to follow him when Ted Swiney suddenly reached across the bar and lifted him up by his coat collar. His amiable act had ended. He growled softly into Charlie's ear. "Anything the old clout finds out, I want to hear about it. You understand?" Charlie nodded eagerly, and Ted dumped him on the floor, grinning round at his customers to show he'd just been having a bit of harmless fun with the boy. His smiling cheeks were red and round as two wax apples. He leaned over the bar to straighten Charlie's coat and pat his hair flat. "Now, hop along. Don't keep Master Creech waiting." Charlie hopped. He scurried out into the daylight, and Bagman Creech nodded once at him and set off up Ditch Street, with Charlie trailing after him and the tip of his black staff going clack, clack, clack upon the cobbles.
Chapter 6. The Archaeologist's House. Fever was perplexed by Kit Solent's home. It was so rich and so poor, and there were so many things there that didn't seem to have a purpose. The high ceilings were crusted with swags and swirls of plaster, which hung down at the corners of the rooms, formed into the shapes of birds and leaves and bunches of fruit, and stained with yellowish dribbles where water had seeped through from the floor above. There were heavy, dusty drapes to curtain the boarded windows, and threadbare carpets on the floors. One room was paved with hundreds and hundreds of tiny tiles, and when she looked closer, in the slatted light that tilted through gaps between the window boards, she saw that they were letters from the keyboards of ancient computers. Ferns and Ruin's toys lay scattered about on the carpets and on the heavy, decorated furniture. There were portraits of Kit Solent and his children on the walls, and in the drawing room hung a painting of a woman with long, dark hair and an absurd, frilled collar. A cluster of candles stood on a table beneath it, among plump puddles of dried wax. "My wife, Katie," said Kit Solent, when he saw Fever look at it. "She died of the blue flu soon after Fern was born." Fever could not think of anything to say. "She's our mummy," said Ruin importantly. The children had followed Kit and Fever in from the garden, and stood now on either side of Fever to look up at the portrait. Ruin said, "We burn candles for her, so that she'll have some light down in the sunless country." Fever wondered if she should point out that there was no such place as the sunless country. She was shocked that the children's father let them believe such superstitious nonsense. And surely all those candles were a fire hazard. But she was a guest in this strange house, and she did not want to offend. Ruin went over to a small side table on which stood a little brass lantern with a pointed roof pierced by patterns of star-shaped holes. Fever wondered if this was another religious ritual, but then recognised the thing as a scent lantern. She had seen others like it in the windows of shops near the head. Ruin chose a vial of perfume from a drawer beneath the table, opened the lantern's door, and let three drops fall onto a lint pad resting on a turntable inside. While he stoppered the vial and returned it to its drawer, his father took out a box of matches, reached into the lantern, and lit the wick beneath the turntable. The rising heat made it start to revolve, wobbling slowly around on its spindle. Ruin closed the door and smiled shyly at Fever as the smell of the perfume began wafting from the holes in the lantern's roof. "That was Katie's favourite scent," said Kit Solent, looking kindly at his son as he shook out the match and laid it on a little shell-shaped dish beside the lantern. "Nocturne in Blue by Eldritch Hooter. It's a sentimental old smell from Scriven times, not like the stuff that gets into the scent parade these days, all those ghastly stinks by Prince Nays and Sniffer Dog. Are you fond of scents, Fever?" Fever shook her head. She knew nothing about scents, except that they were foolish and unnecessary, and Londoners wasted a great deal of money on them. Even so, as the smell from the lantern grew stronger, she had to admit that it served to mask the odours of mould and mildew that hung about the old house. It was a subtle scent, and achingly familiar. For some reason it made her think of lawns at twilight, and big trees standing silent in that time at the end of a summer's day when the breeze fades and all is still. The lagoons, calm as mirrors, held the last of the light, and shadows stretched across her lawns. She shook her head to drive away the image, so intense that for a moment it had felt more like a memory than an imagining. How strange, she thought. She was not usually an imaginative girl. She hoped that her adventures on Straggle Market had not disarranged her wits. Kit Solent, watching her, said, "Are you all right, Miss Crumb?" "Perfectly," said Fever quickly. "Tired from your journey, I expect. Come and sit down." The scent went with them as he led the way through into another room, a large conservatory with glass walls and a glass roof, looking out into a jungly garden behind the house. The room was littered with books, papers, cast-off clothes, and muddy shoes. A cat was sunning itself on a wooden table among plates that still held the remains of breakfast. "Sit down, sit down," said Kit Solent amiably, dumping the cat on the floor and placing a kettle on a stove which stood in one corner. "I expect you'll want a cup of tea after your journey." Fever shook her head and tried not to feel shocked. It is deeply irrational that dried leaves should be transported halfway around the world aboard ships and land barges simply to flavour water. Besides, tea is a stimulant which leads to nervousness and irrationality. "Oh," said Kit Solent, slightly surprised. "Coffee, then?" "Just a mug of boiled water, please." Fern giggled. Kit frowned at her. Fever watched as patiently as she could, while her new employer wiped two mugs and set them ready, then filled a silvery infuser with tea leaves for himself. As politely as she could, she said, "Master Solent, a conservatory is not a rational place to keep a stove. The heat will be lost through all this glass instead of helping to warm the house." "Ah, but the view of the garden is so nice," said Kit Solent, grinning at her foolishly. The kettle grumbled, coming to the boil. He filled the mugs and brought them to the table, saying as he sat down, "It must feel strange coming here after the head. We're not very rational, I'm afraid, but you'll grow used to it." "Miss," said Ruin, "what happened to your hair?" Fever felt herself tense, wondering how to speak to these unreasonable small people. "I shave it off," she said. "Hair is unnecessary. It is a vestige of our animal past, and provides a home for lice and fleas and other parasites." The boy nodded, and his eyes crossed as he peered up at his own tufty fringe, hoping to see some parasites there. "Fever," he said. "That's a funny name." "Ruin," his father warned. "Not at all," said Fever. "During the Scriven era, there was a fashion for women to name their children after whatever ailments they suffered from while they were pregnant. I have heard of people named Backache, Diarrhea." "I knew a man once called Craving for Pickled Onions McNee," agreed Kit Solent. Ruin giggled, and Fever looked disapprovingly at his father. Was he joking? She didn't see the purpose of jokes. The little girl, meanwhile, had decided that Fever was now safe to talk to. She held out the toy dog to her and said, "His name's Noodle Poodle. He's 3. Fever was not sure how to reply to that. She turned to Kit Solent instead. "You have work for me, I believe. Dr. Staling said that you have uncovered an ancient site, and that you have asked for an engineer to help you study the artifacts it contains." Kit Solent took another slurp of tea, and then sat back, lifting Fern onto his lap. He looked slightly embarrassed. "I may have misled old Staling slightly. The site that I have uncovered has not yielded any artifacts yet, but I believe it soon will. Until it does, I am keen to keep it secret. I should hate one of the big archaeological combines to nip in and steal it from me." Fever nodded. Archaeology in London was a cutthroat business, so it was rational that Kit Solent would wish to keep his find a secret. She said, "What is this site? An ancient building?" "Not exactly." Kit looked wary. "I'll take you there, so you can see for yourself. But first we must wait for Mistress Gloomstove to arrive. Mistress Gloomstove is my housekeeper. She will take the children to school, and then we can go exploring." Mistress Gloomstove arrived not long afterward. They heard her open the front door just as Fever was finishing her hot water, and the children went scampering to meet her, Ruin telling her loudly about their new bald-headed visitor. She emerged into the conservatory a moment later, weighed down by bags and shopping baskets, the children orbiting her like eager moons. A large, red-faced, breathless-looking woman, in starched white aprons and an irrational hat. She looked suspiciously at Fever and muttered, "Charmed, miss, I'm sure," when Kit Solent introduced them. "Fever will be staying," Kit told her, taking one of the baskets from her and nodding for Fern to take the other. "Will you make up a bed for her in the room on the top floor? The one that still has its ceiling all intact?" "Of course, sir," said the woman meekly, with another look at Fever. She carried her bags through into a kitchen which opened off at the conservatory's farther end, and the children went after her with the baskets, Fern saying loudly, "And I want all my hair cut off because it gives you pasta rights." After that came 5 minutes of din and confusion while the children found their school things. "They attend Miss Wernicke's school for a few hours every day," explained Kit Solent through the noise. "It's a jolly place, just a single room above a tech shop on Endermoll Street. Miss Wernicke teaches them reading and writing, drawing, singing, and so forth." Fever tried to look interested. She had not heard of Miss Wernicke's establishment. She did not think that Dr. Crumb would approve of it. And then, at last, the children were gone. The house was quiet. She was alone with Kit Solent. "There," he said. "Now, Miss Crumb, I shall lead you to my excavation." Fever followed him. To her surprise, he did not take her back outside into the streets, but deeper into his house. When she thought about it, it was not altogether strange. Ludgate Hill was not a natural hill, but the collapsed and compacted wreckage of a district of immense towers that had stood in this part of London in the 21st century. It was known to be honeycombed with diggers' tunnels, so it seemed quite possible that Kit Solent might have stumbled across some cache of wonders beneath his own floor. They came to a dead end, a corridor that stopped at a large mahogany bookcase, the shelves crammed with worthless novels. Kit Solent walked straight to it, and reached up to press a stud concealed in a swag of ornamental carving. Behind the rows of books, machinery grumbled like a tetchy librarian, and the whole case slid sideways into a deep recess in the wall. "A secret passage," he said, looking expectantly at Fever, certain she must be excited by such a romantic thing. "Rather a cliché, I'm afraid." "Ingenious," said Fever, allowing herself to raise one eyebrow just a quarter of an inch. "Operated by a system of pulleys and counterweights, I presume." They stepped through the gap where the bookcase had stood, and it rumbled back into place behind them while they went down 10 steps into a windowless, whitewashed chamber. It had the feel of underground, that damp brown smell. There was one door, a very small one, opposite the foot of the steps. Lanterns were ranged along a stone shelf. Fever wondered suddenly if she were entirely safe in this strange place, with this strange man. But she could see no way now of turning back. Solent handed her a lantern and used his tinderbox to light it before lighting another for himself. Then he opened the narrow door. It revealed a dark opening, a man-high passage, shored with timber baulks. Stale air came out at them, and along with it the sound of water trickling somewhere far below, and a wet, raw dough smell of secret places deep beneath the city. Chapter 7. Under London. There was a tunnel beneath the house. She squeezed after Kit Solent along the narrow, wood-walled passage, which looked